Okay, this is Cameron and Bob, and we're starting our 68th episode on April 20th, 2023. We've been going for a couple years, and we're on page 165 of my Trump slash Tech Body book.
135, Bob.
What did I say?
65.
Oh, 135. And if you don't have a copy of my book, I can email it to you if you email me. But
you can also just Google for it. It's up at the New Explorations website, right? So,
right. If you have to go. You go in there, and then you go inside that. You have to find where I'm listed in there in their site.
Well, the Google gives a link. I think when you search for your book, the link goes directly to it from a Google search.
Okay, good. So we are going over quotes, so it's good for you to have the quotes visible. Some of them are complex. So we're looking at one at the bottom of page 135, which is from Barrington Nevitt and his booklet called ABC of Prophecy, which he put together in 1980 for the first World Futurist Association's conference in Toronto. I think it was in June 1980, and McLuhan was honored there for his role as a futurist, supposedly, yet he could not speak. He had that aphasia and stuff, and he'd be dead at the end of the year, 6 months later. So Barry had his little book at a booth there, and then he met a guy, Dennis somebody from Concordia University, a professor, who liked the booklet and invited Barry to Concordia to speak to his class. He had some kind of communications class, and Barry went back there every year. And a little story, once Nelson Thal went with him. And it may not have been at Concordia, it may be some other place in Ottawa or something. And they were talking to people in grade eight, students in grade eight. And Barry didn't change his regular speech one iota, as if he was talking to executives to these kids. And that was quite funny to Nelson, that Barry was not really noticing the ground, even though that's what the whole lecture was about. So that's the eccentric story about Barry, and about Barry the eccentric. The other story about him is Margaret Stewart. She saw Barry and Marshall on David Frost in 1972 when they were promoting Take Today, the Executive's Dropout. And Margaret Stewart said Barry Nevitt was like a Mad Hatter. He just talk, and out-talked McLuhan, I guess, and just was too much of a chatterbox for her taste. So there's another example of the eccentric Barry Nevitt, who built the Global Village, or maybe Global Theater, for Norwegian companies all over the world. He was an engineer in the 50s and 60s and built the towers that linked everybody up, I guess. And to finish it off, Ryerson College in Toronto, Ryerson University, was named after Barry Nevitt's grandfather or something. He came from the Ryerson family, the status family of Toronto. But he grew up in China, as his parents were Chinese missionaries, or missionaries in China. So Barry got around. He also was in Soviet Union. I don't know if he was a Marxist, but he was interested in it in the early 30s. So he saw whatever Stalin was doing in Moscow. Then he went to, I think, Munich, Germany, and he saw the Nazis marching down the thoroughfares there in Munich, and they had public address systems and stuff, and they just scared the shit out of everybody. And Barry said he was really frightened by their performance, their electrification on the streets of Munich. So he saw that, then he came back to Toronto. Let's see. So Barry got a nicer copy of this book together, a second edition, and that's what I'm quoting, the second edition, 1985, page 46. So he says, I didn't have the quote yet, did I? No, I don't.
You haven't read it right. On this episode, no.
Right. So the quote says, Marshall McLuhan foresees that consciousness, and consciousness is in quotes, Marshall McLuhan foresees that consciousness will prove to be an effect of speeding up cliché to archetype processes in the brain. So cliché hyphen archetype is italicized in the quote. So Marshall McLuhan foresees that consciousness will prove to be an effect of speeding up cliché archetype processes in the brain. So that's one part of the tetrad. And what does he mean by that? You speed up the turnover of a process of a new environment becoming a figure and a cliche. And that is what consciousness is, I guess, in a way, McLuhan said, in general terms, that people became conscious of the previous environment once it was obsolesced or had become cliche and subsumed by a new invisible environment. And then a cliche, after a while, becomes an archetype. So it's like an aging or a framing of a process, different levels of framing, which is called awareness or consciousness. But that's only a bit of consciousness. You have to see the process, which I would say includes enhancement and chiasmus. So I don't know if Barry's streamlining it or he's, that's why he has consciousness in quotes. It's not real consciousness if it's just a cliche archetype process. So anyways, I have that quote, and then I give a little talk about it, which is in...
Before we go on to your talk, let me just say a few things about the quotation.
Right.
Because it's subject to different readings, and being subject to different readings... gives me the impression of McLuhan's fingerprints on this sentence. It's an example, I think, of the way McLuhan thought and wrote, but which is difficult for people to understand because there are different levels of meaning built into the sentence. So, for example, you pointed out that consciousness is in quotation marks. So the question is, well, what is that? One reading would be that consciousness, and notice that it, he then goes on to say, will prove to be. So he seems to be saying that our understanding of consciousness is going to emerge in the future, will prove to be.
Mm.
But what consciousness proves to be in the future is what it always has been in the past.
And
right? So
it's an effect.
It's like, pardon me?
It's an effect.
Yeah, so the effect is another whole reading of this. The first reading I was suggesting is what might be called a scientific reading. So if we put this into chemical terms, we could say Marshall McLuhan foresees that chemistry will prove to be, right now, when chemistry emerged in the 19th century, there was nothing new about what it was talking about. Chemistry had always been at work, but it hadn't been known. So what was new was a new way of focusing and talking about what had always been the case. And so one reading of this sentence is that through a speeding up of cliche archetype processes, it will become clear what consciousness always has been.
Yes, but what it's always been is cliche, and the knowing of it becomes archetype.
Yes, you could say that, but when there is no such thing as a cliche that is not related to an archetype. So the ignorance of the cliche archetype process was a cliche, but it was always already part of a cliche archetype process, right? That process is something that was expressed but unknown, right? Just in the exact same way as human bodies and the human environment was always chemical, but it wasn't known. So in that reading of the sentence, what consciousness is emerges in an electric environment through the speeding up of the process that has always been in play.
Right, and now there's a larger process. The environment is making people aware of brain consciousness, which is a subset. It's not the complete consciousness that human is experiencing. That's why being quotes.
Yes, but another reading is that consciousness will prove to be, that is to say, what consciousness was, let's say, in the beginning, when human beings first emerged on the planet. And I believe there's no such thing as an unconscious human being. Human beings per se were conscious. But it will prove to be, that is to say, we will come to understand that that consciousness was an effect of the speeding up of the cliche archetype processes. That is to say, the human being was a peculiar type of animal that had a kind of gap between cliche and archetype, which made possible the flipping of cliches. And the flipping of cliches was related to the flipping of archetypes. So this peculiar type of animal existed in a fluid environment that wasn't available to all of the other animals because the cliche archetype process in the other animals was too slow. They didn't have the flip that was always going on with humans, and that McLuhan called the recreating aspect of consciousness. That is to say that for McLuhan, the artistic creation is simply a replay of the creation that's always going on already in all human consciousness, and that creation in human consciousness is the need of human beings to continually revisit the cliche archetype relation.
Right, and it shows that the big complaint for people is they haven't got enough time to live. There's too much speeding up of the environment. But actually, speeding up is has a healthy effect.
Yeah, and a slowing down effect, you could say.
Yeah, it flips into slowdown, but it's a healthy effect. People are not getting dumber. Their terms for what's described, what's going on, is what's dumb. And they need an update of their language, which is what McLuhan attempted. So you need to understand what this sentence is to get to the larger consciousness that's speeding up, even disappearing. There's no consciousness possible in the individual sense. So that's
correct.
Why you have to look at the environment. Your consciousness is outside of yourself.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So the loss of identity in an electric environment cannot be seen only in terms of the Gutenbergian identity. The loss of identity has also to be seen as a kind of positive aspect of the new kind of social identity that becomes imperative within an electric environment.
Yes, it's a positive effect.
Correct.
Or healthy, I don't know what. Do you want to bring in value judgment here? Not really. So.
No, I agree with you.
It's a new experience that if you're hip to it, you can enjoy it. Actually have your senses expanded. So you're actually getting more perceptive.
It's revealing in the sense of light through.
Yeah, transparency. So what I say about it in my little blue type, my conversational statement, I said, I'm reposting McLuhan's idea that the speed up of the cliche archetype process is creating consciousness. I'm sprinkling some other key statements throughout, repeating them to help project the idea of voluntary ESP. So I guess the new consciousness gets people's only terms are intuition or ESP. So I'm trying to explain how we get to ESP, even though it's not that simple to define what ESP is. I just did in technical terms and what you were saying. So this was my way to approach what is ESP using mm-hmm. this quotation.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So then I say, this is not in the blue oral. This is the technical talk, textbook talk here in, in black. Voluntary ESP is a condition of Web 2.0. Now, I have footnote 48 by that. What is that?
You refer to your essay, Cloning ESP.
Oh, okay, Cloning ESP. All right. Okay. So we get back to where it was.
That's the first line after the blue.
Right. Okay. The digital technology, then I say, the digital technology that was being developed on the corporate and military fronts was not noticed. So McLuhan, at best, became regarded as an historian, albeit a comprehensive one, of analog media, despite his chapter on automation in understanding media. But soon, the global membrane is affected by Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, among others, developing the personal computer. That started to radically change the past. All of the old institutions, because that was McLuhan's later definition of the medium. It was the institutions already given as part of the society and were cliche and known. So the personal computer is radically changing the past, all of the old institutions. However, McLuhan himself saw that the notion of the medium is the message age, and mass age was soon to be inapplicable to the law of the situation. Well, that's a pretty interesting statement. McLuhan saw that the notion of the medium is the message, massage, was soon to be inapplicable. Whew. Well, what the hell was I saying? So I make a statement orally. McLuhan and Barry Nevitt serialized Take Today in the magazine Modern Office Procedures in 1976. Talk about hiding it away. So there's something that nobody knows. Have you got those articles?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to Xerox all of them right now, but there's a lot of them. They did about, 12 issues, I think, and interesting summaries of Take Today.
But it's not just word for word from Take Today, right?
I don't think so. I think it's probably got some new statements in there.
Yeah, but, that would be interesting to look at.
Yeah, now what's amazing is okay, I showed up there in summer of 74 with Cynthia Lozier, who knew McLuhan, and she was a friend of Derek DeKirchhoff. So we go into the office, and it's Saturday afternoon, it's open, and we hear McLuhan and some other person talking upstairs, and they're defining terms. And I remember Marshall, I could hear him say, well, inflation is pregnancy. And the other guy said something to that. So they were throwing their aphorisms back and forth each other. Then they became aware we were there, so they came down. And it turned out the man he was talking to was Barry Nevitt. So that's when I met Barry. And they were working on their serialization of Take Today.
Uh-huh.
So we should, if I ever look at it again, I'll see where the word pregnancy shows up, if that's in the serialization. But I remember them saying that. And what a place to serialize it. I mean, he was pretty well, nobody interested in him in 1976. So the best he got, and that's an important, I mean, it's a major book, and a serialization helps people get into it. And they had to put it into an obscure magazine, which is, did he mean that? Would he do that on purpose?
I have no idea. Notice how it's kind of the reverse of what usually happens, right? Usually you have the serialization, and then that turns into a book. And that was already the case with people like Dickens and Dostoevsky in the 19th century. So here you have the 20th century, and you have first the book, and then it gets serialized.
Talk about hiding it away. Okay.
Yeah. I've never seen a single issue of Modern Office Procedures. I've looked, but I've never seen one, never seen the opportunity to buy one.
Yeah, it probably ran for a year or two, and that was it.
Yeah.
So I don't remember. They must have had it at the library. I don't remember buying it, but I remember Xeroxing it a lot. So,
yeah.
You know, U of T library, somebody had it. Toronto was a good place. Yeah. It was the paradise of libraries, Toronto was. It was a literate city. Libraries everywhere. So I took advantage of that in 77, 78. When we first moved there, so there's something unique. Is it listed in the inventory at Ottawa?
Don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, if you while we're doing if while we're talking, if you have a chance, tinker with your computer there and see, you know, you have the list. See if you come up with it. But I don't want it to distract from you. Maybe we'll do it after. Yeah, I don't remember seeing it there. That'd be amazing. This could be the key article or the key hidden something. All right. The next quote is from, this is another obscure thing, McLean's magazine. There was a bunch of people interviewed in the January 74 issue, and there's this little quote by McLuhan, not that very much, not much. And the question is, what's in store for 74? X-ray vision.
Is this the whole quote that he had in McLean's, that issue?
Let's see. I would say it is.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the whole quote. Because, you know, everybody had just a little soundbite.
Yeah.
So what you're going to see in this one, he talks about centralization. He always said before that, you know, it's gone. But he's saying it's still here and it will be enhanced. As well as decentralizing.
Yeah.
That's new.
It's like a commentary on 2023.
Yes. And in that same time in 74, in the fall of 74, so you know, 10 months later, he writes a little notice for a banker's magazine. And in that he says the banker will have to go into politics to get a, you know, economic power is not control in the global membrane. So they have to become a figure in the White House. So right there in the fall of 74, I don't know if it was happening. You have to look up the dates. Nelson Rockefeller was being vetted for replacing to be the vice president for Gerald Ford right after Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
So Nixon resigned on August 8th, I think, 1974, and then they had to get a new vice president because the former vice president, Gerald Ford, had become president. So it's Nelson Rockefeller made his move to get into the White House. Now, that's when the conspiracy theory reality really took off among literate people and journalists and ne'er-do-wells and malcontents because the church committee was going to happen around then, 75, investigate the CIA. So it was all this top-down stuff. And McLuhan was on it, accidentally or intentionally, by, for the first time, talking about the ongoing world of centralization. And that was what was a figure in Watergate and in the church committee investigations of CIA and all that. So now I remember him being interviewed around that time, and he said, we're into not only an information-hunting environment, we're into a man-hunting environment. And that seemed to be the first time he said that, manhunting. So for me, as the global theater shrunk and became a global membrane, and then electric media is becoming digitized and so becoming smaller, the human form, or what I call the chemical body, became figure again. And so people were running around to look at the figure as the cause. So it's actually the environment became embedded in the human form, and the human form was now the cause, not the technical environment. And he has in Playboy in 1968, he talks about, or March 69, he talks about the content becoming environment. So he had that phrase a couple years later, the user is the content. So the chemical body is the content. The content is the new ground. And in the speed up, which he talks about on page 11 of Take Today, you can't tell the difference between the man and the figure, the ground and man. So It's all coming together there. And so that's where looking for who's causing what, which is what happened in Watergate, the grievance. Where's the grievance applied? So McLuhan actually switched from technologies were the ground. It had sped up to now the human form was the ground, or at least right. as much as part of the technical ground. And if you look at that quote, I think I have it. I should have it in here. His statement, a technical statement about man becomes both figure and ground. That's what right. I'm seeing in this quote here. That I'm going to read. I haven't read yet.
Yeah. Let me just say that I'm doing some posts right now. I've published two of them, I think, online at the New Sciences website on exactly this topic. I call it the harmonization of the planet, which is a phrase from McLuhan.
And let me say this. Remember the phrase in Take Today, we go from the dehumanization of the 19th century mechanical era to the superhumanization of the electronic media. That is the, in Take Today, that's another way of what you're talking about.
Yes, sir. Yes, it is. But I think we need to be careful. You said that the human form is the chemical body. It includes the chemical body, but I don't think you can equate the human form as McLuhan uses it with.
You have
the
to bring in the
body.
Discarnate face. Like, no, I know it's difficult. I mean, later I get the four or five bodies model, but I'm just sort of talking simply now. And yes, it should be corrected what I'm saying, but yeah, it's not the human form. But you know, there is this rearview mirror aspect where there's this. The humans are now superhumanized, super angels, or harmonizing of the environment. The human thinks it's a person, a chemical body, and they run around manhunting chemical bodies to see who's causing what. You see what I'm saying?
Sure, sure.
That's the rearview mirror.
It's a misperception that sort of drives commerce and drives everything else.
Yeah, that's probably the beginning of pointing out how the tech body and Trump merge. You know what I mean? There's more to Trump than Donald Trump, the chemical body.
Yeah.
Which people don't understand. So, okay, so let's see what this quote says.
Yeah.
So here is the one among 10 people, just another voice in the ether, and he says, major political trends in the immediate future are bound to relate to the effects of TV on North Americans. Does that mean not TV on the rest of the world? You know, is this like, that's the environment, TV in North America? I don't think so, but I'm just looking at it, what he's saying there.
Yeah. I think he means that the effect is first of all to be seen on North Americans, because the TV has been broadly in people's homes for longer here than elsewhere.
Yeah.
And so it's just, you read, it's like reading the future in the present. It's not that the effects of TV will be limited here. It's just they're readable here.
Yeah. Major trends, yeah. Major political trends in the immediate future are bound to relate to the effects of TV on North Americans. Now, if you actually said that today, you'd be called a racist, I think, right? Highlighting the North Americans too much. So, the power of TV to reveal the motives of action in the human countenance is part of the general X-ray process inherent in electric technology. Now, there's a sentence you never saw him say, those words like that. The power of TV to reveal the motives of action in the human countenance is part of the general X-ray process inherent in electric technology. He has in Take Today, the question is the face, is your face or your name your fame or something, your key to fame? Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember that, but it's interesting given recognition technologies going on and being used as passwords for computers.
Right. So the human countenance, the TV reveals a lot in the human countenance. That's why people start wearing sunglasses all the time, no matter where they are.
Yep.
Okay, the Watergate hearings made this clear when the boys in the back room became show business in quotes. The impossibility of secrecy under electronic conditions makes espionage, and oh, there's manhunting, the principal activity of our time, and renders all the old forms of wheeler-dealering impracticable.
Yeah.
That's
what notice the two readings of show business, right? You have show business as media and movies and all that sort of stuff. But in an electric environment, everything becomes the business of showing.
Yes.
Right? Of electric technology allows things to be read.
Yeah, there's no more secrecy.
Yeah.
The impossibility of secrecy under electronic conditions makes espionage and manhunting the principal activity of our time, and they would show old-fashioned espionage and manhunting where the TV shows, I Spy,
yeah,
whatever other ones, there was all kinds of them in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And also detective shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
notice how it's typical of McLuhan to have a show business in quotes like that, and then to explain what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Most people would read that as sort of going on to something else. But in fact, he's going backwards to say, you know, here's what I mean.
Yeah, impossibility.
He often does that.
Everything's on show. No secrets.
Yep. Exactly.
And what was I just saying before that? I don't know if I had something that I said. I don't know. Do you remember what I said a minute ago?
You're talking about manhunting.
Yeah, manhunting. In the 70s, the major figures of TV for adults in the 70s were those detective shows like Beretta, Columbo, you know, manhunting.
Yeah. What was the John Cassavetes one was good?
I don't remember that. You mean he was the Asian guy? Kung Fu?
No. There was Mike Hammer was one, and then the competition to Mike Hammer.
Magnum P.I. was another.
there was a whole raft of them. Yeah.
They were the main things. I remember somebody telling me his father, you couldn't talk to him on Sunday night. He had to watch whatever was on, Columbo or something. Every week he had to watch it because that was the way people replayed the process of cognition of living under electric conditions.
That's right.
Everybody was a detective just to see, quote, where it's at and what's going on. You had to keep up with the pattern recognition.
That's right.
So the game that mimed that, the game is an art form that mimes the main activity of society. So the main activity is espionage and manhunting. So the game of that would be detective shows.
Yeah.
You know, Telly Savalas. What was he?
Yeah.
He had suckers. Lollipops.
Yeah, no, I remember it well, but I can't remember the names these people used.
Right,
I think
but
one guy was Johnny Staccato, wasn't he? And
I don't. I didn't watch them. I wasn't into TV. I just knew about them. But the thing is, these are archetypes for that era.
Absolutely.
And that's the pop culture. That's the Dickens of novels of the 19th century. Now are these figures in different major media. And the detective, because television could be more the present than movies. It could show the process across society faster. So the detective
and
shows.
Notice how these things have become impossible, right? You cannot have a good Western or a good detective show anymore.
They have to be self-conscious and deprecating, self-deprecating.
Yeah, yeah. So the only good cowboy is like a woman cowboy or a gay cowboy.
Yeah, a gay cowboy.
And the only good detective is like a four-year-old girl or something.
Yeah, or some transgender dupe. So what? So this is interesting about this. So McClune was talking about the power and the reason for detective stories and Edgar Allan Poe and all that stuff in the 19th century. It was the beginning of the retracing of the stages of apprehension and the effects preceding the causes. All that stuff was in the detective fiction of the 30s. Remember Q.D. Leavis wrote about the sin of reading detective thrillers?
Yeah, yeah.
So
That was the power of the readership market over what was written by authors.
Well, I would say it wasn't the power of the readership market. It was the power of the detective form because it met the needs of the new electric probing, or even newspaper times in the 19th century. So McClune said that, you know, Edgar Allan Poe was a major inventor, and he invented the detective story. So, and then the Symbolist poets developed stuff from Poe in France. But so McClune is talking about how the detective thing, it's already an archetype almost for McClune in the 40s.
Sure, yeah.
So then we witness it as content in the global theater, from the 60s on. Right. So
yeah, just to put a footnote in there, McLuhan's essay on Poe was published, I think, in 1943.
Yeah.
And he then included it in Interior Landscape in 1969.
Yeah.
So it's one of the earliest essays included in the Interior Landscape, and it's important to see that McLuhan thought it was topical.
Yes, and
25
guess,
years later.
Yeah, and I was talking to John Cage in New York about 1975, and I took he did a performance, took a friend to him. So we went out after, a bunch of us, you know, at a restaurant to talk, and at one point I said, "What do you make?" I knew all about his involvement with McLuhan. But so I said something like, "What do you make of McLuhan?" He says, "Well, I regard McLuhan as a detective."
Uh-huh.
And shortly after that, McLuhan had himself photographed with the Sherlock Holmes costume on.
Yeah.
So this is important.
And,
you know, McLuhan.
Cage was a detective of mushroom hunting.
Yes, yeah. And you have to look at, here's the detective taking over in pop culture in the 70s. So McLuhan, he didn't show himself as a detective in the 50s or 60s. He did it in the 70s to reflect what was going on and how he was on top of it with his costume. So that's the part of the theater of McLuhan or the comedy of McLuhan.
Or the tragedy of McLuhan, because it all reflects an inability to communicate, driving him to try new means.
Yeah, words weren't making it anymore.
Correct.
So, the impossibility of secrecy. So, see, and he says in Take Today that, or even on the back cover, the book cover sleeve, he talks about all the old institutions of espionage become fodder for showbiz. It's not actually where the business, where the knowing is. Political espionage, corporate espionage, is for the motivated somnambulist. If you want to see what is worth knowing and what is the process of secrecy, what is still secret, even though secrecy per se, bureaucratic secrecy, is gone, what is the new secrets? That's what he was showing. The new
yep.
secrets, temporary. Anybody could be could see them if it was pointed out to them. Okay,
yeah.
so this
and
is a very
notice
good...
how that's a replay of what he was doing with advertisements.
Yes,
right. He was saying that what people think is manipulation in advertising isn't where the manipulation is. The manipulation is behind that.
The focus groups.
You have to see it as a palimpsest. You have to be able to look through the obvious manipulation of advertising to understand the real manipulation that's going on, and that's environmental.
Yeah, the people objected maybe instinctively to advertising as an aesthetic experience, but they gladly joined any focus groups or any be in ads. Everybody would try to be in ads, you know. So
yeah.
There's the hypocrisy there of getting it mixed up, missing what the ads were. And so the advertising, it was accepted that these companies could come around anywhere and say, hey, people, we want to hear your opinions about this and that.
Yeah.
Nobody knew that was espionage. They're too busy worrying. Are you a communist?
I get email every single day asking for my opinion.
Yeah. I don't. I've never given an opinion. Never had one.
No, of course I would never ever answer anything like that. But
see, this is such a
continue to arrive.
Yeah. So this is that's the Android meme. They have no respecter of persons. They don't care what you said before. You're still fodder. But what's incredible is this great statement is in the middle of other stupid comments about whatever people said.
That's right.
I think I only made a copy of McLuhan. I should have copied everybody else just to contrast what silly things.
Yeah, McLuhan could be read as a comment on those comments.
Yes. Yeah, he would say, this article is the example of espionage. You're not making any money off me, so I'm going to say some stuff you don't understand. But it's talking about Watergate. That's the headlines coming out of the White House. That's the ground on the content level and about the process of what was going on. And, you know, he said advertising was part of daily espionage.
Correct.
So there's so much in this little quote.
Well, this one sentence about electric power will be used by the old guard of 19th century minds to implement even further the patterns of centralized hardware and authority. I mean, that's a perfect reading of 2023.
Yeah. Electric power.
Amazing.
Yeah, electric power will be used by the old guard of 19th century minds, which is still there. Old media, it's hard to get rid of old media or old memes. Electric power will be used to implement, hijack even further the established, I'm putting in the word established, the established patterns of centralized hardware and authority. And there will be a continuing rejection of consumer values and specialism. And there's the problem. The bureaucracy that runs the consumer level, the economy, the money zone, they got a problem selling their stuff.
Definitely.
There's a rejection. Now, there's also a flip maybe by the 80s where people's identity became shopping. As fundamentalism took over around the world, religious fundamentalism, America's techno involvement of new environments became our fundamentalism. So people took on shopping as a statement of political identity. And Bush, you know, in 2001, after 9/11, he told everybody, okay, resume shopping, which is a crazy statement. So this is a 70s mood, 60s and 70s, that's going to be flipped in the 80s.
Yeah, and notice after COVID, people were supposed to resume shopping, right? It's the same meme has been flipped over. Over and over again for the last 50 years.
Right. Now, isn't there a problem with shopping in that now? Isn't the economy suffering or inflation or something? They weren't able to retrieve the shopping as well.
no, the malls are closing, et cetera. But if you go to stores these days, they're packed. The freeways are packed. The stores are packed. People are trying to get back to where they were.
Yeah.
They have no idea where they were. So it's very hard to do.
And the malls are closing?
What's that?
The malls are closing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why? Well, they're packed. Well, nobody's got any money to buy anything?
I think that's the case. But for decades, malls have been sort of becoming lower class. And that's why they're closing.
Oh,
the big brands have been extracting themselves from malls.
Okay, and so that's also the takeover of Amazon, digital shopping.
Yes.
Yeah, you don't
certainly
need
involved.
You don't need to go to the mall.
Yeah, yeah. So people don't go to the mall to shop; they go to the mall to be in some sort of social experience.
Right, and that wore out over the last 40 years, 30 years. It's now low class. It's a ghetto now.
Correct.
Yeah, a lot of homeless people probably hanging out there. Okay, so there's an interesting effect. So so that's a very – he doesn't talk about this other places. Electric power will be used by the old guard to further prop up patterns of centralized hardware authority. See – he always thought, oh, that's all going to go away, or he emphasized that point. But this is the first time you're seeing it's the start of the movement toward 1984, that icon.
Right. And part of the problem for a person like McLuhan is that what he is seeing is 50 or 75 or 100 years in the future, and he's talking about that, and he can't believe that other people don't see it.
Yeah.
But nobody sees it.
Yep. Which is odd. Well, it's a strange experience being a prophet. I know it well myself. What's wrong with you people? It's pretty obvious what I'm seeing. What was that? He used to quote a cartoon, Little Abner or something. And Barry used to quote Little Abner. If anybody can see, I can see it. I think that was his statement. Okay, so this is a great quote. Now, why do they put it there? So what do I say? I raised that question. What's special about this quotation? This is my oral rambling. What's special about this quotation? It's the only time I ever saw one of its themes. It's the only time I ever saw one of its themes. McLuhan's usually talking about trends of decentralization, but here he's saying, no, centralization will continue. And that gets us, well, there you were talking about this, that gets us up to the Patriot Act, 2001. In other words, that old obsolete surveillance, centralized surveillance, Big Brother operations still goes on. It's a phase of technology in the first half of the 20th century, but doesn't go away. One can't stop it. While the decentralization is people making their own clothes, for example, girls making up their own fashion styles, rejecting packaged consumer patterns. That started in the 70s. A lot of the boomer women would start buying 20s clothes. I remember that fad.
Yeah.
That's what's important about this quotation above. It's the first time McLuhan acknowledges that centralization is carrying on. It's still occurring. And you see the previous sentence in the quotation rehearses the typical espionage and manhunting theme. That's in quotes, espionage and manhunting theme. Normal business activity. Watergate was the old boys network in showbiz. It was a known in the information society that secrecy was obsolete. There was nothing to hide. Therefore, the hidden Big Brother is casually exposed here by McLuhan. It's referred to. It's not a threat. What's a threat now is not to know or understand the X-ray power of television in the later media. Well, that's a mouthful. Any comment on that?
Well, I mean, it is a mouthful, but it's more or less what we were talking about prior to your blue text here.
Yes.
McLuhan saw that something like TikTok would be seen as a centralizing power.
Yeah, this is... his theme of everybody getting involved, participation. This is hyper-participation,
yeah.
And it gets organized. By this time, the managers of the society understand this.
Correct. So
yeah,
it seems like it's decentralized. Everybody can do their own thing. They do their own thing at minute X and at minute X plus one. And those two things don't have to have anything to do with each other, even for the same person. And then you take that over all of society, and it seems like you have extreme decentralization. But in fact, it's extreme centralization.
Right. So then by the time you get to Reagan, you have a yearning for a sense of re-centralization. So the 80s were considered super conformist beyond whatever people thought the 50s were. And so the hyper-conformity, at least of one aspect of public consciousness, comes in with the Reagan era. And Reagan is seen as trying to get the world back to a small town mentality. But see, that's the image of centralization.
Right. Yeah. See, centralization gets broken apart into bad centralization and good centralization.
Yeah.
And so under Reagan, what people are looking for is how do we find good centralization again?
Yeah. So the conspiracy theorists are still running amok in the 80s. And seeing this as a trilateral commission and David Rockefeller taking over, they don't see it's actually the people want a centralized. Big Brother's good. They like Big Brother. They like Ollie North and his plan called Rex 84 in 1984. It came out of the Iran-Contra syndrome. But the interesting thing is people are misidentifying causes and effects. And so... You know, what's his name? Biden. He came out last year saying there's too many people being conspiracy theorists. He complained about it, you know? See, that's a symptom of misidentifying what's going on. Like you're saying, this 2023 is looking for a centralization. But, of course, for the whole global membrane, which is called the world or globalism, you know, technically – the old terrestrial environment is what people think is being organized into a global structure. That's a long time ago. We've got solar government problems is what's really trying to be organized now, a yearning for centralization on the solar level. So what I'm saying here and what you're supporting is mandatory definitions of the new elements. I'm laying out the E equals MC squared, the technical terms for talking about what's happening, not
Correct.
Any of the journalistic terms or the journalistic panics. Be interesting if a lot of people heard this stuff, what would they do with it, you know?
Yeah, that's sort of a great question hanging over the world.
Yeah. Okay, so... do I need to reread this again? I don't think so. So I do make this interesting statement. What's a threat now is not to know or understand the X-ray power of television in the later media. So people like Croker and the postmodernists were start talking about a screenal economy. It wasn't a TV economy. It was screen. Like there were screens everywhere, computers, TV. So.
Right.
I think that screen is what I'm getting at, the X-ray power of television for all media, all analog media. That's the beginning of the digitization, the digitized ground makes the screen the X-ray of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's no secrets. So then everything becomes obscene, or what was called obscene becomes marketable.
Yeah, so if we go back to the quotation from Barry Nevitt at the bottom of 135, Marshall McLuhan foresees that consciousness will prove to be an effect of the speeding up. You say in regard to that what's the threat now is not to know or understand the X-ray power of television and later media. What you're saying, along with Barry, is that there's a new sense of consciousness that is shaping things. But as we go about shaping things according to that sort of consciousness, we don't know what we're doing.
That's right.
And that's where that's the threat.
And then that becomes a desire for external centralization. Somebody out there must know what they're doing. Let them take over.
Yes.
So
and there's a good and a bad sense to that, right?
Right. So 1984 comes in, and nobody is worried about it. This joke, it's joked about
they don't
all year
see
long.
It. They don't see it.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Well, it flipped. So that's why he said back in 1950, Orwell was a doofus. He had no clue what was going on. He was not preparing for us, preparing what was happening for us. So I remember Christopher Hitchens, you know, the famous Washington journalist, praising George Orwell in 1984. There's a guy who, rearview mirror, and I actually met him at one point. There was a conference in New York City I went to at New School of Social Research. I don't know when, but this would be mid-90s. And on the panel was George Steiner, friend of McLuhan's, Christopher Hitchens, Zizek, before he became well-known. You know that guy Zizek, Z-I-Z-E-K?
Sure.
Zizek and some other well-known guy. So before the conference, I did not know who Zizek was. I saw this guy in a very hyper state of panic talking to someone else. And I said, that guy is like, he's like having a breakdown in front of everybody. So then the panel started, and this guy, who turned out to be Zizek, continued to be in a hyper paranoid, odd, hyper state, very inappropriate compared to the relaxed George Steiner and Christopher Hitchens and the other guys.
They've been doing that today.
Beg your pardon?
He's still like that today.
Yeah. So I said, this guy's ridiculous. I missed the ground. He was the ground. He was going to become the big figure, the McLuhan of the next 10 years, you know?
Yeah.
And I saw him when he was, okay, maybe he was seeing something no one else saw, or his concepts that he could say about it. And so his writing style was becoming popular, but he probably was ready to be noticed, and he wasn't being noticed enough. Anyways, Christopher Hitchens, first of all, Steiner, before or after the panel, I can't remember, he came up to me and says, we just got talking, and I think I brought up McLuhan and that, and then he says, why are you here? So I'd like to see what academics are doing. He says, we're a waste of time, Bob. Steiner told me that he was being honored at the New York Library around the same time, public library. You know, he was a big archetype.
Yeah.
And yet he didn't believe in anything he was doing. You're wasting your time, Bob. But I knew I wasn't. I wouldn't have known he would say that. That's why I knew we're a spy, for fuck's sake. I was doing great espionage. And then Christopher Hitchens comes up to me, and he says, what do you know about – oh, I asked him questions at point – you know, my questions showed that I knew a lot about McLuhan, and that it was relevant to what they were saying. So Hitchens comes up to me, and he says, you know anything about Harold Innes? I said, yeah, I know a lot. He says, I need to find out some stuff. I want to write about McLuhan, but I'm going to do it through the Innes angle. So I don't know what he knew. So a couple days later, I give him my phone number. He left a message, and then I called him back, no answer. And then he called me back, and he said he was leaving town, and he couldn't meet. We were supposedly starting to get to meet. And I never heard from him, so he forgot about it. Other things changed his mind or got him focused. It was probably just after Wired magazine, you know, McLuhan was back in the imagery again. So he would have to do his hit job on him like he did them Mother Teresa.
Yeah, that was his style.
Right, but he got distracted. So that was the end of my Hitchens engagement. And let's see, there was a guy named Paul Ryan who was in the audience. You know that name, Paul Ryan?
I know the politician, but I doubt that
no.
that's the same guy.
Okay, so he came up and introduced himself to me. And, yeah, he introduced myself to me. And he was a McLuhan fan. So as I got to know him, and he invited me over to his place in the West Side and gave me his history, he was Carpenter's assistant at the Fordham scene in 68.
Huh.
And he was a priest. And he was listening to McLuhan and those guys in 66, 67, you know, when they were doing the Tony Swartz scene. And I heard him on WBAI, and he said, oh, these guys are interesting. This is a guy who's a Catholic, but maybe he's not sure if being a priest is important anymore. So he went over and got talking to McLuhan, and then Carpenter showed up, and then he became a great friend of Carpenter. So, again, by going to this ridiculous panel in the afternoon of a Wednesday that nobody would go to, I had all kinds of interesting connections came out of it. That's what you had to do. You had to go to the ground. The panels were ground in a lot of cultural activity. And that's part of the meaning of my book, Fatty Communion. It's a panel, which is the main form of knowing for everybody in society from the 80s on. I mean, corporations, medicine, everything. Everybody went to panels, right? Go to conventions.
Yep.
Business write-off. But the panel, you know, a mosaic of opinions that McLuhan was supporting, it's like an interdisciplinary on the popular level. Do you know what I mean?
Correct. Yeah, yeah.
So it's a major cultural phenomenon. You don't hear people talk about it as a cultural phenomenon, which I'm doing right now for the first time. Well, I've said it before, but for here.
Well, Dalí talks about panels in that interview he did in 68.
Wow.
And McLuhan, of course, was saying that everything has to become panels. Right, the news has to become panels and all this. And when McLuhan sort of laid down the pattern that was followed by the news teams.
Yeah, friendly teamness and teaming.
That's right.
Friendness
correct.
Or something. You know,
that
thing he did for ABC News in 71, that pamphlet. I don't remember seeing him say everything has to be a panel. Where did you see that?
Well, I don't know that McLuhan said that. Well, of course, that's what networking is all about, right?
Yeah.
It's a panel.
Yeah.
I'm saying that Dalí talks about panels.
Well, that's amazing.
And talks about them being dead.
That means they're obsolete. Everybody's going to be doing it.
That's correct.
So that's an interesting pattern. So why were we talking about the pan? I like my idea. It's the popularization of interdisciplinary studies. You know, explorations in the 50s, McLuhan's group was the first panel in academia.
Yeah.
Turned into a magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
What else were we saying? So, panels were what I was an anthropologist of. I studied panels. I went to a lot of them. In New York, that's where I got to see all the names in so many fields, you know. And the other phenomenon was Barnes and Noble authors. That's another big phenomenon in literate America, is the authors coming around doing a book tour and speaking at bookstores, and everybody, they have to be grilled by the public, they have to be interrogated, investigated. Whereas they have to go through the public espionage of them.
Yeah, you can say that manhunting is going on by the consumers of these people.
That's right. Yeah, manhunting is, I mean, I always thought if I had a book and I had to tour, I wouldn't like it. That would be a drag, going around having to sign books and answer people's stuff. And probably I'd want to give good answers, but you couldn't in a short, brief bullshit, you know, just be phatic. So,
correct.
I'm glad my book didn't make it.
You'd be monetizing your signature.
Yeah. I remember Carolyn, she had a book coming out, might have been The Miracle of Magnesium in 2001 or 2002, and so she was scheduled to go on a book tour right after turned out to be 911. So it got canceled. So she was happy because you had to do it. The company would make you go on a book tour.
Yeah, it was probably part of the contract.
Yeah. And so she was relieved by 911 from doing that. So that was good. Let's see. We did that quote.
So this is, we're on 137.
Yeah.
And you have already done the blue text, but the black text, which comes after that, is interesting because we've sort of already talked about it without getting into it.
Okay. So I see that it starts above that, the black stuff. The message. So I'm saying McLuhan himself saw that the notion of the medium as a message was soon to be inapplicable to the law of the situation. So this is, I guess, the effects there, the decrease of consumer values, the espionage. People actually stop buying stuff maybe in the long run because they're too busy spying and watching. You know, the huge popularity of the discussion shows on Fox and CNN. It's nothing but panels. It's not news anymore. It's just opinionating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's,
but they,
that's
part of the problem was that people already had everything. It became hard to find stuff that you didn't have.
Right. So you'd watch panels trying to explain why you didn't have anything anymore.
Yeah, but it's also McLuhan's notion of communism, right? That we already have it. It's not something that we need a revolution for, number one. And number two, it's not something we need to fear because we already are it.
Yeah, I noticed I was thinking of that today, in Lewis. He knows that people are going through hardware communism. He calls it the proletarianization. And the elites don't notice this. That everybody was proletarianized. But he was also picking up, starting to perceive the software communism, which he called the educationalist state. And he saw this information thing taking over and obsolescing the artist. But he doesn't get as far as McLuhan. When you read Lewis, you see that McLuhan redid Lewis and completed Lewis and sort of tidied up the groping of Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
So
could the reverse also be said? When I read Lewis, I see too much conceptualization going on. Too much. He's trying to find what the pattern is, and what happens with McLuhan is he kind of blows up the conceptualization going on in Lewis. And lets things be more messy.
Right. Now, Lewis knows that his conceptualization is not his real goal. It's not getting anywhere. So that's why he spends a lot of time satirizing other people's concepts and, in a way, wasting his time. But at the time, before McLuhan, the people weren't ready for what McLuhan was going to do. So they were quadriphenically engaging with all kinds of concepts and getting rigidified on the centralized level in politics in the 30s. And Lewis was caught in the middle of it all with a greater awareness, but he didn't have the process clear enough that McLuhan got later because it was later. And it was a replay for McLuhan. I mean, he replayed Lewis. So, but I would say that Lewis, in the end, he makes fun of concepts. He is ultimately working from a perceptual level. And that's why they can't figure out what he is, what's his opinion. And he seems to be just hopping all over the place, taking pot shots at everybody. But he has to know their concepts to do it.
Yes. Oh, I think that's true. So he's sort of doing hip-hop, but he's not happy about having to do hip-hop.
Yeah.
He would like to be able to write or draw in a way that made sense a sense of sense that has disappeared.
Yes, he was trying to get back to the waltz. He called it space.
Yeah.
As a verse versus time and rhythm.
That's right. That's right. Get away from time.
Yeah. So, but at the same time, it's interesting. He is learning to adapt to the present, even though he's complaining, fighting all the way. He's doing better than other people. That's American Cosmic Man in 48. He tells the Europeans that you don't know, America's the future. And, you know, yeah. Europeans are still snobbish toward America. Their Parisian sensibility. You know, like Trudeau, when he was a young rich kid in the 40s, he goes to Paris. They think that's where it's at, you know. They don't get what's going on in America. You probably can look it up. Trudeau probably went to Paris in 48, and here's Lewis telling them, no, no, go down to New York City. Go just to America, and you see the real action of the global theater, becoming the global theater. So the Lewis, he's very good at if you can see, read him closely, you don't end up labeling a fascist or a Hitler lover or something, you know?
No, no, of course not. Of course not.
But that's all the establishment could say about him back then. They couldn't. He was threatening people with his knowing.
Oh, absolutely. They were afraid of what he was saying.
Yeah.
They couldn't digest it, and so they had to attack him.
Yeah.
And you see that they had to silence him.
Yeah. He got canceled.
That's right. A lot of what was done to Lewis is what's done regularly to everybody.
To you and your neighbor. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we're doing, I go down here and there's a quote, well, culture of quantum fluctuations. It got cut off. Do you see the black part?
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from.
Yeah, so, okay, well, I'm just going to go back up and read the next quote above it. So this is... interview, Marshall McLuhan, McLean's Magazine, March 7th, 1987. Why do I have that in letters? Why would this interview be in the letters? Is that correct?
I've kind of lost where you are. What page are you on?
At the top of 138. The previous quote was 136 into 137, then there was the long blue part, and then a new quote I'm going to do, which is at the bottom 137, but I'm looking at the identity of it, 138. And it says it's an interview with McLuhan in letters.
It's letters is kind of a funny book in that sometimes they stuck stuff in as a letter that had actually appeared in some other form.
Mm.
And that may be what's going on here. I'm not sure.
Okay, we'll have to look at that later.
Yeah.
So anyways, this is now McLuhan's coming near the end of his days. It's 1977. So here's what he says. Well, when things change at very high speeds, a need for continuity develops. Okay, there he is. The centralization retrieval desire.
Yeah. Yeah.
The novelty of acoustic and tactility in the 50s and 60s for North Americans has worn off. They're now yearning to get back to their chief feature, as Gurdjieff would call it, which is visual space and the fundamentalism of the culture built on the book. They're trying to get back to that now, right? It's gone too far.
Yeah, I mean, that's the dialectic slash dilemma that is still at play.
Yes. So, well, he says, well, when things change at very high speeds, a need for continuity develops. You see, you're in such a complete discontinuity at high speed. Now, see, what's good about these quotes is this is way beyond Madison Avenue, 1967, McLuhan. McLuhan's dealing with what's changed in the next decade and what's coming. And no one talks about what he saw in his later work in the 70s. You know what I mean?
Sure.
No wonder
he's
said,
the only one that he saw then what's going on now, and people still don't see what he saw then.
That's right. The Okay,
you were talking about his later work and not.
Yeah, but then a big change is his op-ed in 1974, A Media Approach to Inflation.
Yeah, I knew you were going to bring that up.
Beg your pardon?
I knew you were going to bring that up.
That's an archetype in Bob's mind. The but the thing is, I would be reading this stuff in the 70s and go over to the coach house and you know, the regulars there, they didn't know about it. They didn't read it. They didn't, hey, look, McClune's talking what's happening right now and making interesting patterns. And some old fogey would say, McClune hasn't been relevant. Oh, I remember. He says with the cliched archetype in 71, he says, this book is way better than Understanding Media. And you have nothing since the last 50 years of saying McClune's main work is Understanding Media. You know, that's silly. So what is good about what I'm presenting here are these quotes that nobody knows. And we're spelling out, look at what they're saying. It's beyond what anybody else is saying as a futurist. He's actually talking technically about what's happening to people. So he says, you see, you're in such a complete discontinuity at high speed. Everything you're looking at now is gone in a second, and our demands are to hang on to older things. So the antique store, there's the antique store fashion I was telling you. So the antique stores and the love of taking the varnish off of old tables, revealing their original state, and that sort of thing is a passion today. I remember in Toronto in the 70s, everybody got into rebuilding their homes or getting old homes and rebuilding them. And,
still going on.
I don't see any of that in Maui, so I'm out of touch there. And revealing their original state and that sort of thing is a passion today. See, he was always noticing what his neighbors was doing. That's all he was doing. He wasn't trying to write a novel. Wasn't trying to. The work became a novel in a way later, as it accumulated. But he wasn't trying to make a movie. He with conversational media, you could just notice what your neighbor's doing and go on Robert Fulford's afternoon show and say a few patterns. That was it. You wrapped it up, put it away. Hollywood would try to make movies out of it, right?
Yeah, so what I see going on here is McClune looking at the surface of things and saying, you know, here's what's going on.
Yeah, he was postmodern. The surface told more than, quote, literate depth. And remember his definition of manipulating satire to somebody, and maybe that Hornianski guy in 1976, he says, manipulating satire is a satire of the manners of the surface manners of life, the surface manners.
Yes, but the notice that when you have discontinuity at high speed, that is disconcerting, disorienting, disorganizing. But on the other hand, it permits a new kind of reading. So the discontinuity of surface and depth is what allows the reading of the surface.
And that's finning its wake.
Yeah. It's everything in an electric environment.
Right.
It's the electric environment reveals, but it does not reveal except through discontinuity.
Well, you're getting to tactility is becoming a figure. So
correct.
What is the ground? Yeah. And I was sort of seeing the human form, the anthropomorphic physical, as the ground. I was trying to show that in my chart. Just to see if there was any human reality for yourself was the new pressure.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's discontinuity as explosion. And what had to be appreciated was the implosion in that explosion.
Yeah.
So the human form is the natural need of humans for creativity. And what's creativity? It's the gap between cliche and archetype. It's what everybody is doing all the time. but don't know that they're doing.
Okay, but, so this is where I explain why my quadrant, the fifth quadrant on the chart, is anthropomorphic physical. You have people, now the kids, that whether they want to be puppies and things, the anthropomorphic is being challenged or being broken up, and nobody knows what is anthropomorphic other than the environments around them.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's see if I get to that. I think I do get to that about the AP and the AM later, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So this is the first time we've walked right into explaining the effect of tactility becoming figure, which is what he lays out in Media Approach to Inflation, and that becomes gambling on futures, you know, in Wall Street, gambling on the interval. The interval is now figure, and it's a rapid interval. And, you know, like we know that the Wall Street companies, they move out to New Jersey to be near the machine that runs Wall Street, and they try to get their cables as close to that building so that they can see the signals before the other guy, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which is ridiculously non-anthropomorphic, non-human, for fuck's sake. But what is the economy when you're doing that? Do you know what I mean? What is the economy? It's hyper-communication in a ridiculous level where it's just for the machines. It's basically...
Yeah, and the machines. And notice the conflict with the word economy, which basically means household in Greek. So you have a distension between this crazy idea of the economy being entirely a matter of being first, and then you have economy as the household, that is to say, what at the end of the day is last.
Yeah.
Right? And those things become dissociated.
And then people don't know they are families anymore, and then they start claiming they're different genders.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's saying the varnishing is a new passion. In order to think, you have to forget most of what you are experiencing in order to relate it to earlier things that you knew. Otherwise, you can't infer anything from what you are seeing. What an incredible statement!
Yeah,
and no publicity for that. Now that's in McLean's magazine. You know, Peter, who was the guy at McLean's that liked him, the editor. Peter somebody, he didn't stop. He didn't, he highlighted the interview, but nobody made a headline out of it. I mean,
the guy's name started with New.
Newman.
Peter Newman, yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, McLuhan got Global Village and Medium as a Message as a headline. This should have been a headline. In order to think, you have to forget most of what you're experiencing in order to relate it to earlier things that you knew. Otherwise, you can't infer anything from what you were seeing. Those statements should be well known. I mean, that you can see people when they took drugs, they were going through that experience. You know,
sure. That's what we were just talking about with the need for distance, which on the one hand is disorienting, but on the other hand, it's enabling.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the problem that people are caught up in.
So you can see why, you know, the Bible prediction at the mark of the beast and this global centralization known as the Antichrist and all that, you can see why that's coming. That people will want it. It's an extension of the centralization retrieval.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so then...
Yeah, it's an attempt to see where it's at.
Yeah. And then to bounce off. When you see what's at, which is... You're looking, you can't see anything. You demand some reasonable supernatural form to take over. All right. So
notice how that, what you just said, notice how it relates to what you just read.
Yeah.
Right? In order to think, you have to forget most of what you're experiencing.
Yeah, you have to go back in the past to find something that you like, that's familiar. That's what I'm going to be. Your identity is in another part of identity, right? Looking for something in the past that you can claim fits your astrological sign or something.
Yeah. And that is the humanization of the planet, or the hominization of the planet.
Right. Right. So at the speed of light, which is now the normal speed of most information on TV, radio, telephone, and so on, at that speed, the need to forget has become a form of nostalgia. Wow. The need to forget has become a form where you can't forget the present. Well, you're living in the present and it's attacking you, so you hope not to be able to see it. But you can't get back to anything. You'll try, it won't work. So trying to get back, which is seen as a nostalgia, fails. At the speed, the need to forget has become, you're yearning for when you could forget.
Yeah. I mean, this is typical of McLuhan's writing, which I don't even know if he did it consciously, but it's just a whole series of levels.
Yeah.
Is both an example of thinking and an inciting of thinking at once.
Inciting?
Yes, an inciting. So when he says that the need to forget has become a form of nostalgia, you can say nostalgia is not forgetting, right? So the need to forget has become a form of not forgetting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a very complex statement. It's a joy to try to grapple with.
Right. Remember you used to say the past ain't what it used to be, the future isn't
yeah.
so thinking ain't what it used to be, or pattern recognition ain't what it used to be.
Correct.
Forgetting isn't what it used to be. So anyways, kudos to me for finding these quotes.
Absolutely. I think I have his letters here. Let me look up
177.
177 to see if...
what's going on there?
Or if it's a good reference.
This is an excerpt from McLean's magazine, supposedly.
Yeah, you know what this is? It's part of a discussion. It's not a letter. It's the editorial discussion introducing a section of the letters.
Right.
And so it's one of the things that sort of gets screwed up in this edition. I'm trying to see. Oh, here we go. It's, it's a quotation from that McLean's article. That's in an editorial insertion in the letters.
Yeah, by William Toy.
Well, yeah, Toy and or Corinne and...
Matty. No, it was Toy. I remember Dave Neufeld's father was a good friend of Mr. Toy, and we heard a lot of Toy's complaints working with Mrs. McLuhan and Matty through Dave's father. So,
yeah.
Again, I find out what's going on behind the scenes and the level of anthropomorphic grievance.
Correct. They weren't happy. They also weren't happy with him.
Oh, where'd you hear that?
There was a lot of tension going on.
Where'd you hear that from?
From Corinne.
Oh, okay. The thing is, he did a good job. His footnotes are great. He fills in everybody.
Well, sometimes. Sometimes they're not accurate, but... The thing is, he tries to be a little bit of a know-it-all.
Yeah.
He tries to say stuff like what McLuhan was really talking about or what he was really referring to.
Right.
So I'm not a big fan of Toy. Maybe you like him better than I do.
Well, at least he was reading stuff that no one saw and commenting on it. That's what I liked. He learned a lot doing that.
Yeah,
book.
Okay, that's right. So what he did is he allowed McLuhan to inform him.
Yeah.
That's the best part of his notes.
Right, and then his content response is what you're complaining about. Like, he got informed, but he may not have seen it perfectly. It was all...
Well, and sometimes it's misleading.
Yeah.
And what I meant by him working with Corinne and Mady on his notes is that sometimes there's stuff that can only have come from Corinne.
Okay.
Like when she talks about McLuhan's blackout starting in 1959, that's in a note in the letters. Toy didn't know anything about that.
Yeah.
So that comes right from Corinne, and she got it in there.
I think I like that Toy would give good footnotes about all the different people that were being written to. You know,
yeah.
He looked it up. He was thorough. Everything
Correct.
Was explained.
His stuff is often surface.
Yeah.
You know, so he'll say something about somebody that McLuhan knew in Winnipeg. But the footnote will talk about the guy being a professor at McMaster in Hamilton or something like that.
Yeah.
Right? And he doesn't know that there was this deeper connection to McLuhan and McLuhan's family back in Winnipeg.
Right.
But it's, I mean, it's not horrible. It's just, you know, the letters that we have is one volume of four volumes that were put together. And the OUP and Toy then cut it back to one volume.
Mm. I didn't know that. There were four volumes worth?
Yeah.
Wow. So,
and there's a lot of information about this at the York University website.
Ah.
I'll send you a link if you want.
Yeah,
because,
I've never seen that. The York University
Yeah,
has
that's the... what am I trying to say here? The papers of I forget the name of the business that Mady had, but all of her papers are at York.
Wow.
And so the original four volumes of the letters are all there.
You're kidding. There's all kinds of letters there?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that. I don't know if I have time to go back there, but it's very interesting. Certainly didn't know that. When did that all happen?
I don't know when the papers went there, but I think they've been there for at least 10 years, maybe longer.
I don't think anybody knows that. You're the only guy who knows this.
Well,
send me the link, and I'll put it on around the various McLuhan places to turn everybody
okay.
on to it.
Fine. Yeah, so the original edition was four volumes, cut down to one, and all of that stuff is at York.
So there's all these letters to people that aren't in the first volume that we don't know about, but that are – I saw the cabinets, man. They were big. There was a lot of letters. So many of those letters, if you don't go there, you're not reading a lot of stuff that's new.
Correct. So in the different biographies of McLuhan, there's often quotations from letters that aren't in letters.
Is that right?
And those quotations are often very interesting. So
yeah.
That gives a hint of what's in these other three volumes.
So you haven't gone through them all?
No, uh-uh.
Okay, so you're saying
that
some writer...
Pardon me?
Okay, what were you just saying?
That I haven't seen those letters, but I have to go and see them at some point.
Yeah, we can see them online, can't we?
No.
Oh, they're not online.
No. All it is reference to them.
Wow, so you got to go up there. So there are people who will quote a letter or two, and you look it up, it's not in the letters book.
Correct. And oftentimes... for example, in Terry Gordon's book, he quotes letters that are in Ottawa and are not in letters.
Yeah.
But I don't know that anybody has done a thorough job on the original four volumes of letters.
No, that's incredible. Well, that's new information there, people. Okay, so the link you'll send me will give me a guide to whose letters are there.
Yes.
Oh, wow, that'd be interesting. You mean I got to go back to Toronto one more time?
maybe. But I don't want to promise that there's a breakdown of every letter. I haven't been at the site for a while, and I don't know how reliable my memory is of it. But I'll send you the information, and maybe the next time we talk, we can go over that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. All right. Well, we did that quote, very important quote, and then I say, this is McLuhan saying what Arthur Croker writes 15 years later about A, and then I have it in, oh, that's right. This is a very important sentence from Croker. That's what it is. It should be in blue. Do you know what I mean? But it's a quote, so I'm highlighting it. So it's a mixture there. So you see that? This is McLuhan saying what Arthur Croker writes 15 years later about A. This is what Croker said. We were in a culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. There's an excellent quote, but redoing McLuhan.
Yeah.
What a great quote. I quote that a lot, that we're in a culture of quantum fluctuations where, you know, it's very tiny fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you have never really heard what you were listening to. Oh, man. This is, it's not post-human. You could say it's post-anthropomorphic. Humans can project anything. So, not just human. And so, I think we might see this a lot in the millennials. Their identification with communication itself, known as texting, right? The fetishizing. The unable to stop looking. So you gotta keep looking at your, what's it called, Black Mirror, to see what you're not seeing. So that gets into the negative form of mathematics or negative forms of physics, right? We're living in negative nothingness.
Yes, definitely.
That's an interesting
point. And that's what, in my reading of cultural history, that's where Nietzsche deposited us in the 1880s.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to deal with what he called nihilism.
Well, this is where...
Which is the everywhereness of nothing.
Right, and that's why, you know, Trump was a phase of development from that. He couldn't finish his sentences, but Biden's even more of the president. He can't finish his syllables. But it's the nihilism of communication. So Biden is a perfect image of where we're at.
Yeah, and your idea about Trump is that he's a perfect image, not necessarily of where we're at, but of the engine of where we're at. Can I put it that way?
Yes, but he's the tech body. And,
yeah, but isn't the tech body the engine of where we're at?
Yeah, and I would say that the White House is not an engine anymore. That's why, you know, you put a weakling in like Biden, but everything is still all about Trump. Still impeaching him, still driving him, still trying to catch him, Rumpelstiltskin. Because that's the tech body. That's what we're actually up against. I don't know if Trump is that because he got there first, or he himself is so quadriplegically, you know, discontinuous in so many ways that a Biden image is too limited. It doesn't cover. He's not doing anything. Trump is doing things all over the place. No, he's engaging every one of his extended faculties. Biden, you know, in a way, Trump is trying to prevent the Biden effect on himself. He's busy everywhere, trying to rebuild stuff. And Biden gave up. His image gave up. He's not even bothering governing. He went to Ireland and he says, I like it here. I'm not going back. Okay, so that's an interesting point of my book, is that I might have to do an addendum talking about the meaning of Biden as an extension of Trump, you know?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so...
I want to point out here in that quotation from Croker, you mentioned that it's a redoing of McLuhan. And in fact, it's the sort of thing that McLuhan did all the time.
Yeah.
And pointed out the dialectic between looking and listening. Right? So I'm doing a post right now, actually. I just put it up the other day on McLuhan taking the rear view mirror and making it into the ear view mirror.
You
right?
know,
and that,
go ahead.
Well, you were.
I was inspired to say something.
Yeah, go ahead.
In an article in the mid '60s, I think it's called "The Crack in the Rearview Mirror," he talks mm-hmm. about the rearview mirror as the art form.
Uh-huh.
People think, you know, you don't want to be involved with the rearview mirror. Well, that's all you have at a certain point.
Correct.
And so it becomes which is the best kind of rearview mirror to use.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
In a speed up, there's nothing new.
Yeah, what he used to say, what is the cliche? There's nothing old under the sun. He used to say, there's nothing new under the sun or something? Or no. I think he used to say, there's nothing old. He changed it. So what's the cliche? There's nothing old under the sun.
Nothing new to nothing
new.
Old.
Nothing new under the sun is the cliche. So there's nothing old under the sun. Ah, that's nothing is obsolete. If everything's obsolete, then everything's usable. So everything, and that's part of, I think, the quantum media approach to inflation is that everything is insurable. Nothing is old. Everything is new. You find new places to put value in, temporary value. You get that?
Well, I don't. I thought you were saying that everything is replay, but then you flip into.
Yeah, everything is new. Everything is, quote, exploitable. Okay, if obsolescence defined by McLuhan as it's useless, so it can be sold.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's obsolete, so it works. Well, that means everything is obsolete, so therefore it can work. So everything becomes new again, becomes retrieved. And in the media approach to inflation, he talks about how everything is insurable. You can make anything be insured. So that means it's new. You can find new value in long-lost things.
Yeah, I think this is, isn't this just a variation on etherization?
Yeah, doing more with less. Well, how about doing more with everything? So maybe it's the opposite now.
But notice we've gone back to the Barry Nevitt quote about consciousness.
Yeah.
Right. If
everything becomes consciousness, now that's part of the anthropomorphic projection.
Correct.
So if you're projecting human comfort or security, you insure everything. I mean, he lists a bunch of absurd things that are insured. I can't remember them. But some of them are pretty crazy back in the 70s. So what do people insure today? what? I don't know. I don't do it myself.
For example, you can, if you're a football team, you can insure yourself against injuries.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, the insurance industry has reached into everything.
Yeah.
So you can insure yourself, if you're making a movie, you can insure yourself against it not being completed.
Or even making any money.
Yeah. Well, if it's not completed, all you do is lose money.
Right. So, yeah, that's what I'm getting at. So there's nothing old under the sun. The cliche is there's nothing but old. But no, there's nothing. Everything's new. Everything is you can project values into it. Coker wrote about that in the 80s. The valuation of values just went excessive. That's like everything as content can be a temporary ground. Literally a ground, security.
Mm-hmm. Well, go ahead. I can feel that. I can feel that there's a thought here that needs to be expressed.
Okay, so maybe I'll do it here in my the blue section. So I say, I say, well, here's the forgotten McLuhan quotation where he's saying much the same thing. Quote, you have to forget most of what you're experiencing in order to relate it to earlier things you knew. End of quote. You can't refer back to the reference. You can't infer anything from what you're seeing. That's a very useful McLuhan statement. He's starting to get into, like Croker, what you can't see. You're not using your eyes. Your eyes aren't necessary. That's the global membrane. Actually, you have to retrieve thought and the ability to think up stuff that no one else will think about to create a temporary ground. So you don't go by what people are knowing. You've got to come up with what they don't know, what they aren't thinking of. Not in terms of the ground. You can make anything ground by your retrieving an idea and a memory of something that used to be existing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ground is always already there, but it's all that's known of the ground is a figure. So then what happens in an electric environment is that the ground becomes exposed, but it becomes exposed in its plurality.
Yeah.
So,
which is your discontinuity.
That's right. So people used to think that they had a problem at the level of figure, but now it turns out that they have an analogous problem at the level of ground. And that is absolutely disorienting. So
yeah,
the
only way
forward is to go into that deorientation, that absolute loss of orientation.
Right, so this is where I get into page 139, part 4, Android Meme, phase 2. So we've completed Android Meme phase 1, now Android Meme phase 2, and McLuhan said electronics is ESP. So it's been a world of ESP, for 100 years. Now we get into voluntary and involuntary ESP. That's my new categories.
Uh-huh.
For what you just said is what we got to do. So maybe we should stop there. It's a whole new area.
Yeah, it's a good boundary stone. Sure.
Yeah. Now, let me just check part 3. Is that called Android Meme Phase 1? I think it is. Trying to find my list of chapters.
Go back to the start of the book.
Yeah, so I have Global Village, then Global Theater, then Global Membrane or Android Meme Phase 1, then Android Meme Phase 2, and then Anthropomorphic Physical. See? There it is, anthropomorphic physical, and then tech body. So there it is. It's what's coming. We're getting into the good stuff now.
Okay, good.
Complete.
But some of those topics we already named in our discussion today. So that's cool.
Yeah, we're keeping up with ourselves.
That's right.
Okay, well, that's really good. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
Okay, you too, Bob.
Yep. Talk to you soon. Okay,
yep, bye. Bye-bye.